This morning I would like to share with you a very unique and ancient social practice that took place in the land of Israel in its early history as a nation. And some of you might not be aware of this existence, of this particular thing they used to have. Others of you may have studied it and found it very enjoyable. It concerns cities of refuge, sometimes called asylum cities. And it was a place where a man could run and hide if he had accidentally killed another person. Well, take the time to go to the very beginning and read about how these cities were instituted and their purpose. And if you'd like to follow along, you can get your swords out of their sheaths, and we'll be turning to a few texts this morning. Now, if you want to go to Numbers 35, in the Old Testament, Numbers 35, beginning at verse 9, I want to read several verses because it gives the content, context, and how this actually worked. Numbers 35, beginning at verse 9. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into Canaan," that's coming out of the wilderness, "select some towns to be your cities of refuge, to which a person who has killed someone accidentally may flee. They will be places of refuge from the avenger, so that a person accused of murder may not die before he stands trial before the assembly." If some of you are just getting there, it's verse 13 now. Numbers 35. "These six towns you will give to be your cities of refuge. Give three on this side of the Jordan and three in Canaan as cities of refuge. These six towns will be a place of refuge for Israelites, aliens, and any other people living among them, so that anyone who has killed another accidentally can flee there. If a man strikes someone with an iron object so that he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if anyone has a stone in his hand that could kill, and he strikes someone so that he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if anyone has a wooden object in his hand that could kill, and he hits someone so that he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. He shall put him to death." Have you ever thought about that? If somebody kills somebody else, then any member of that family can go to the murderer and kill him the same way he may have killed his loved one. That's the way it worked in the old days here in Israel. "If anyone with malice aforethought shoves another or throws something at him intentionally so that he dies, or if in hostility he hits him with his fist so that he dies, that person shall be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood," that is the person that might come after them, "shall put the murderer to death who meets him. But if, without hostility, someone suddenly shoves another or throws something at him unintentionally or without seeing him, drops a stone on him that could kill him, and he dies, then since he was not his enemy and did not intend to harm him, the assembly must judge between him and the avenger of blood according to these regulations. The assembly must protect the one accused of murder from the avenger of blood and send him back to the city of refuge to which he fled. He must stay there until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the accused ever goes outside the limits of the city of refuge to which he has fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the city, the avenger of blood may kill the accused without being guilty of murder. The accused must stay in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. Only after the death of the high priest may he return to his own property." Now from this, we discover Israel was to set aside six Levitical cities as cities of refuge. Three were to be on the east side of the Jordan. Three were to be on the west side. We presume this was to make the cities strategically located so that they could be quickly and easily reached by someone running for them. We see these cities were for those who killed accidentally. That is, unpremeditated, a death caused not out of the heat of passion. To make a modern-day comparison, suppose a man was hunting in the woods and accidentally shot another man through the trees or bushes, thinking that he was a deer. And then suppose one of the dead man's relatives determined to kill the innocent person who made a bad mistake by not being sure at what he was shooting. In these days of ancient Israel, he would simply probably drop his gun and take off as fast as he could and go for the closest city of refuge. There, as long as he remained within the walls and confines of the city, he was safe from the man who was out to get revenge. A little more information is found in the book of Joshua, if you want to turn there. Chapter 20. Joshua chapter 20 at verse 1. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Tell the Israelites to designate the cities of refuge as I instructed you through Moses," which we just read, "so that anyone who kills a person accidentally or unintentionally may flee there and find protection from the avenger of blood. When he flees to one of these cities, he is to stand in the entrance of the city gate and state his case before the elders of that city. Then they are to admit him into their city and give him a place to live with them. If the avenger of blood pursues him, they must not surrender the one accused because he killed his neighbor unintentionally and without malice aforethought. He is to stay in that city until he has stood trial before the assembly and until the death of the high priest who is serving at that time. Then he may go back to his own home in the town from which he fled." The cities of refuge were established to protect anyone from the ancient right of vendetta, blood revenge, without first having legal counsel and a fair trial. The cities of refuge were to give the accused a chance to make his case before a court. Arriving at the nearest asylum, the manslayer evidently presented a summary of his defense at the gate, which was the ancient law court. It was a large, mostly enclosed area where a conference could be heard. And so he would state his case there and explain what he had done and that he was on the run and he was wanting refuge in the city. Later, he was brought to stand trial before the congregation in the community nearest the scene of the crime. This is in other scriptures, but he is then taken, protected to the community of the man that was killed. He stands trial there. If acquitted, he is then returned to the city of refuge until free to return home at the death of the high priest. That death meant a change of priestly administration or acted perhaps like the statute of limitations. And also it let those of the family of the man who died to cool off and protected the man who was thought to be guilty by the family but was really innocent. It was an unintentional death. To clarify this practice in Israel even further, let's look at another text if you want to go there. Deuteronomy chapter 19. It's found at verse 4, beginning of verse 4. Deuteronomy 19, verse 4. This says, "This is the rule concerning the man who kills another and flees there to save his life. One who kills his neighbor unintentionally, without malice aforethought. For instance, a man may go into the forest with his neighbor to cut wood, and as he swings his axe to fell a tree, the head may fly off and hit his neighbor and kill him." It's interesting that as a child I was cutting wood, and one day the axe head flew off as I was swinging it down to chop a piece of wood. So this is just an example the Bible gives that it flies off and hits your friend or your co-worker, and it kills them, then this is an accidental death. That man may flee, the one with the axe handle without a head on it, that man may flee to one of the cities and save his life. Otherwise, the avenger of blood might pursue him in a rage, overtake him if the distance is too great, and kill him, even though he is not deserving of death, since he did it to his neighbor without malice aforethought. So that's one reason why they had the cities rather close, so that by the time the family heard that this man was dead, he would have time to get a head start and get to the city be safe. This text clarifies the type of killing that the cities of refuge were established to protect. We've all heard about the Hatfield and McCoy feud. That was in 1878 to 1891. And it has become a metaphor for bitterly feuding rival parties in general. It involved two warring families of the area of West Virginia and Virginia, Kentucky area. I don't know if Pam has any relatives that was in that group.
I don't know that, but I have visited Devilance Hatfield's grave. It's not far from my parents.
Really? Uh-huh. All right. Basically, this is what these cities were for, to stop lifelong feuds, to stop one man running for his life and another man from searching him down until he kills him. It was a unique type of justice and mercy, giving a man a chance for a fair trial before he was killed in cold blood without the benefit of an explanation for what really happened. It avoided the Hatfield-McCoy type of thing. We just go over there and kill them because they killed one of our brothers or something like that, even though it may have been accidental. There is one more text I want us to notice that illustrates this same principle of justice and mercy for the innocent, and this was before the time of the cities of refuge were established in Exodus chapter 21. Exodus 21, beginning at verse 12. It says there, anyone who strikes a man and kills him shall surely be put to death, meaning that if he does it intentionally. However, if he does not do it intentionally, but God lets it happen, he is to flee to a place I will designate. But if a man schemes and kills another man deliberately, take him away from my altar and put him to death. Now, here we see that a premeditated murderer could not go to a sanctuary or an altar for mercy and refuge. I'm sorry, I should have said could go. He could go to a sanctuary. He could go to an altar to try to seek mercy and refuge if he had killed someone accidentally. But an unintentional killer could run there for safety. I guess I still got that wrong. A true murderer could not run there, but an unintentional murderer could run to the altar, to the temple, to the tent of meeting, and try to seek safety. But at the same time, an altar may have been at a great distance, and a person could not constantly remain close or near the altar. And so finally, further provisions were made for the innocent slayers through the cities of refuge. Just one of several examples of how the altar served as a place of security is found in 1 Kings. You may recall that this is where Adonijah, through some political maneuvers, tried to become king instead of Solomon. Well, it didn't work. And when his underhanded schemes were discovered and exposed, his friends left him, and Adonijah had to flee for his life. We'll look at those few verses if you want to go there. 1 Kings chapter 1. 1 Kings chapter 1, beginning at verse 49. At this, all Adonijah's guests rose in alarm and dispersed. That is, his friends left him because of this evil plotting. But Adonijah, in fear of Solomon, went and took hold of the horns of the altar. Then Solomon was told, Adonijah is afraid of King Solomon and is clinging to the horns of the altar. He says, let King Solomon swear to me today that he will not put his servant to death with the sword. And Solomon replied, if he shows himself to be a worthy man, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground. But if evil is found in him, he will die. Then King Solomon sent men, and they brought him down from the altar, and Adonijah came and bowed down to King Solomon, and Solomon said, evidently after some interview with him, go to your home. He let him go. This illustrates that the altar and the horns of the altar that were on each corner of the altar, like ram's horns, or the sanctuary or the temple, was considered a place of asylum and security. Men who feared God, even men with evil intent, would not step over, at that time, the laws and pursue a man to kill him in the sanctuary or the temple or at the altar. Even in relatively modern times, men often ran to hide inside the churches, hoping that the avenger would stop at the door and respect the place as a house of God. And in those days, evidently, even evil men wouldn't enter the sanctuary or the temple area to kill someone. They had that much respect for the church or for God. You know, many times churches used to often leave the doors unlocked because at one time men revered and respected the house of God and wouldn't think to go in and steal or do harm or damage. But nowadays, of course, churches are not off limits for crime and robbery. Men's hearts have become so sin-calloused that even God is not respected or feared, and men do not hesitate to use the church in any way they can to get away with things. And thus Adonijah fled there, clinging to the horns of the corner of the altar, hoping and begging for mercy from King Solomon. And thus the sanctuary or the altar was a prelude to the more sophisticated system of mercy and justice as found in the city of refuge. However, Joab, a willful murderer, killed two commanders of David's army in the time of peace, and he could not find mercy at the altar. In 1 Kings 2, we read, "When the news reached Joab, who had conspired with Adonijah, though not with Absalom, he fled to the tent of the Lord and took hold of the horns of the altar. King Solomon was told that Joab had fled to the tent of the Lord and was beside the altar. Then Solomon ordered Benaniah, son of Jehoiada, go strike him down. So Benaniah entered the tent of the Lord and said to Joab, 'The king says, come out.' But he answered, 'No, I will die here.' Benaniah went back to the king, reported to the king, 'This is how Joab answered me. I'm not leaving the altar.' Then the king commanded Benaniah, 'Do as he says, strike him down and bury him. And so clear me and my father's house of the guilt of the innocent blood that Joab shed.'" So even hanging onto the altar and a willful murderer, very evil, even Solomon had him killed evidently at the altar, right there. Now you may be asking, why have we taken this time to dust off some ancient history and habits of the nation of Israel? What good does this ancient custom do for us in the 21st century? We don't have anything like cities of refuge today, so why even consider it? It's a fair question. First of all, we do so because we know from Paul in the New Testament that everything recorded in the Old Testament was recorded, as he wrote, for our admonition and instruction. Now, if Paul, who saw Christ alive after his death, told us that the Old Testament history has real value, then we can rest assured there is something of spiritual significance in it for us. We all know that many, if not all, things physical in Israel's day now take on an intangible spiritual significance. And as you would, all you would have to do, of course, is to read the book of Hebrews to be convinced of that truth. And thus the physical cities and the physical altars, the temple, the priests, a host of other physical things have today for us intangible spiritual implications. Jesus pointed out this physical and spiritual difference one time, and the changeover, when he said to the woman of Samaria, he says, "But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for such the Father seeks to worship him," in John 4. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. So Jesus here just spelled out to this woman that the days of meeting God in Jerusalem and in the temple was over. No longer do you have to walk down to Jerusalem or walk up to Jerusalem to worship. You don't have to go to a certain geographical location. Jesus told her you can and will worship God anywhere, even right where you are, in your spirit and in truth. A paraphrase puts Jesus' concept this way. It's who you are and the way you live that count before God. Your worship must engage your spirit in the pursuit of truth. That's the kind of people the Father is out looking for. Those who are simply and honestly themselves before Him in their worship. God is spirit. Those who worship Him must do it out of their very being. Their spirits and their true selves is adoration. So the simple application of the cities of refuge is this, that God is our refuge. Anytime, anywhere, we don't have to run to a certain designated city, or to the temple, or cling to the horns on the corner of the altar for safety. We can run to Him in times of stress, in times of heartache, in times of trouble, when the enemies pursue us, figuratively speaking. He is there to protect and to shield us from harm. It's only natural that David uses and speaks of refuge many times in the Psalms. After all, it was in his time, about 1,000 years before Christ, that these cities were heavily being used. And David was especially familiar with them. I'll just give you two, but they're all through the Psalms. In Psalm 91, he says, "You are my refuge, my fortress, the cities and the walls, God in whom I trust." So you see David using the cities of refuge as a way of saying, "You are my refuge, God." In Psalm 7, "O Lord my God, I take refuge in you. Save and deliver me from all who pursue me." So David, of course, was always fretting about people who were after him and hated him. And so he's saying, anyone who's after me, pursuing me like the cities of refuge and the avenger of blood, save me. You are my refuge. So you see that David is using this very symbolic way of finding refuge in God in connection with the cities of refuge. Of course, today in our lives, our refuge may be our job or our bank account or our own intelligence. My fortress is my lawyer or my contacts I have with the city commissioners or my own gun that sits beside the door. And as for trusting God, they say in their behavior, "I don't trust anyone, including God." And how terribly sad that people have not even tried God as a city of refuge. Remember when Jesus said to Israel, "How often I would have gathered you together as a hen her brood, but you would not." God wants to protect us. He wants to gather us under His wings. He wants to make us secure. He wants us to find refuge in Him. But He can't if we won't seek after the sanctuary that He provides. Jesus said, "I wanted to bring you together. I wanted to protect you, but you just wouldn't let me." The word refuge appears only one time in the New Testament. And it's only logical that it should appear in the book of Hebrews. As the title of the book suggests, it's the only book in the New Testament that specifically addresses the Jews in the context of their own culture almost entirely. In Hebrews chapter 6, "Wherein God, willing more abundantly to show unto their heirs of promise the immutability of His counsel, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things, in which it was impossible for God to lie, we might have a strong consolation, who have fled for refuge, to lay hold on the hope set before us." Disregarding the subject matter being discussed here in this text, we simply note that Paul actually uses the expression, "fled for refuge," that is obviously a wordplay on the cities of refuge with which the Jews were so very familiar. He also makes a word play on "lay hold upon the hope." As the Jews once remembered, those fleeing to the house of the temple would lay hold of the altar, grab the horns of the altar, cling to the altar. He is saying, we flee to God, who is our sure hope from the avenger of eternal death, who by two immutable things, and of course, as he just said here, that is His promise and His oath, as He made it to Abraham and many others, He says, "We have an anchor to the soul, a hope that enters into the inner shrine behind the curtain," which figuratively, of course, is the breaking through of the flesh and entering into the very presence of God Himself. So you'll recall the innocent party living in the city of refuge was free to return to his home upon the death of the chief priest that was in charge when he entered the city. It represented, I believe, that the guilt of the slayer rested upon the priest, and upon the death of the priest, his guilt was then atoned for, and then he was free to return home. He probably could have been in the city for maybe a week and the priest would die, and he could go back home, although the heat and passions of the family would probably still be pretty strong. Or it could have been 10 or 15 or 20, 30 years before he could leave the city. The antitype of Christ, though, is so obvious that a child, I think, can see that our guilt and our consequent forgiveness has been purchased and covered in the death of our high priest. Because of his death and sacrifice, we are now free to leave our city of confinement and return home, like the prodigal son did to his home and his father. Our true high priest has died willingly and obtained our release and our salvation from our enemy who pursues us, which is eternal death. God, through Christ, is our city of refuge from the enemy of death.